First edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Tuesday. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Coming up in the second hour of the show, we will talk to Navashadeh and Fanon Hill, the team that is bringing us the Cherry Hill Arts and Music Festival, two of my favorite people, quite frankly. They are the co-founders of the Youth Resiliency Institute. They'll be here in studio to talk about the Cherry Hill Arts and Music Festival, the first annual of that type of event. Looking forward to that. Also, Miss Peggy Jackson Job will be here. She's a 46-year veteran educator with Baltimore City Public Schools who's doing work with Navashadeh and Fanon. So that's coming up in the second hour of the show. Also, the African Diaspora International Film Festival featuring Invisible Roots, Afro-Mexicans in Southern California. We'll talk about that festival with Tiffany Walton, co-director of Invisible Roots, as well as Diara Nda Speak, creator and founder of the African Diaspora International Film Festival. That's all coming up in the second hour of First Edition. A little bit later, in this first hour, we'll be joined by our friend Ron Cassie, senior editor of Baltimore Magazine. His latest story is on the legacy, the towering legacy of Thurgood Marshall, 50 years after his installation as the U.S. Supreme Court's first black justice. That's coming up a little bit later in this first hour. But first, we'll get a report from the recently concluded NABJ convention in New Orleans. Carla Wills, senior producer of Democracy Now!, former executive producer of First Edition, is on phone. Carla, good to hear your voice as always.
Good to be with you, Sean.
Charles Robinson is also on the phone. He is a veteran reporter for Maryland Public Television State Circle. Charles, good to hear you too, brother.
Always great to be back in B-more.
I know it is. And Pia Jordan is in the studio with me. She's assistant professor of multimedia journalism of the School of Global Journalism and Communications here at Morgan State University. She's also MSU ABJ advisor. Pia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So before we get into the conversation, I want to let our listeners know to make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or get on my Facebook page if you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me. I'll share it to people unless you don't want me to, and of course, I will not. Before we get into this conversation, you all, I'm just coming literally back from the site of vandalism, more vandalism, against a protest statue, the protest statue Madre Luz, that was erected in protest of the Civil War monument to white supremacy that is erected in the Wyman Park Dell close to the Baltimore Museum of Art. This statue was erected last year, I believe, was taken out of the park by park rangers and then defaced 24 hours later with the word nigger on the side of it. The same statue was placed in front of the Robert E. Lee Stonewall Jackson Monument, and literally moments ago before I came on the air, I saw it lying on its side. Two white men, I spoke to an eyewitness who was on the scene just moments before I was, two white men walked up to the statue and pushed it over and then sped away. We just heard a report by NPR talking about how the president, the 45th president of the United States, again, blamed both sides in the Charlottesville attacks, the domestic violence attacks that killed one person and injured 19 others. Let's be clear. This latest incident of what just happened here in Baltimore with this protest statue being pushed down in broad daylight by two white men, The fact that the president, the 45th president of the United States, again, after being condemned by just about every side, Republican, Democrat, and everything in between, again, blamed both sides for what happened in Charlottesville. If black people in America don't understand fully and completely that we are at war right now against white supremacy, we need to wake up. This is what's happening. All these people have been emboldened by the election of the 45th president of the United States. I understand that there are people in Baltimore City, brothers and sisters, who are struggling with jobs, who are struggling with addiction, who are struggling with poverty, and they're not worried about any statues. But believe me, all of us are in this war against white supremacy right now because it's happening right now. And I don't think I'm misspeaking, and I don't think I'm overspeaking. I'm mad. I'm still hot from what I just witnessed. If I had been there 30 seconds earlier, I probably wouldn't be on the air because I probably would be at Central Booking right now. That's how mad I am, because to come into Baltimore City and have the audacity, the boldness to come and do what they did, that speaks to a different level of white resentment or white entitlement. This is our reality. This is our reality. So with that, we can begin our conversation, but I'm interested in hearing what you all think about that, because I know that obviously there was a member of the Trump administration at NABJ in New Orleans over the weekend, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Y'all can talk. I'm all right.
Well,
I just wanted to make sure you were okay. You know, Sean, we're here in the newsroom at Democracy Now! And just finished watching the president's speech, the latest one where, you know, he just reiterated, went back to his original statement that there was violence on both sides. And, you know, he pointed out what he now calls the alt-left. These people with their masks and their faces and the helmets and, you know, their baseball bats, and how they also attacked and you know, that there were people who weren't neo-Nazis or, you know, who weren't white supremacists, who were out there peacefully protesting the taking down of the Robert E. Lee statue. They were innocent. They just, disagreed with the removal of the statue. And if you take down Robert E. Lee now, this is what the president's saying. If you take down Robert E. Lee now, what's next? You know, he says George Washington owned slaves. Do we take down his statue? Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. Do we take down his statue? Where does it stop? What's next? This is what the president just said today.
Yeah.
Just moments ago. So yes, you're absolutely right. This is what we're up against. Again, he's talking about violence on both sides and how, you know, this is, you know, basically violence all around and everyone shares blame. We, NABJ, and, you know, just for background, the National Association of Black Journalists, you know, represents some 3,000, you know, plus members around the country. There were about 3,300 who were there in New Orleans for the annual convention. You know, had invited Omarosa to come and speak at a panel that was to deal with threats facing young black men, police violence, you know, mass incarceration, you name it. The panel opened with the mother of Philando Castile and the aunt of Alton Sterling, and it was a very powerful conversation. And Omarosa was, this is where the disagreement comes, she thought she was on to talk about how violence has affected her own family, not police violence, just violence. She lost her father when she was 7 to violence, and then a nephew, and then members of her class. She grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, talked about the crime and violence there and how she was affected. She thought that's all she was going to talk about. There was a disagreement about the fact that we had invited her to come on as a member of the Trump administration, talk about what the administration is doing about state-sanctioned police violence. So this is where it all kind of went off the rails. It was a very tense conversation between moderator Ed Gordon and Omarosa, who felt threatened. And, you know, so it escalated from there. I'll get into that later. But the fact is, we had this representative of the administration who didn't feel it, I don't know whether she didn't feel comfortable speaking for the administration or you know, whether she knew in this audience, which she would say to defend this administration, wouldn't go over well. But, you know, that's kind of where we are in recapping what happened at NABJ this past weekend. But this is, again, this president who obviously is no friend, as we long known, to this community.
Well, let's be clear. This president is the most anti-black president since Woodrow Wilson. And she was a representative. She's a member of his administration. So for her to have the audacity to come to NABJ in any capacity, to me, it blows my mind. I'm serious about it. She represents the Trump administration, whether she wants to admit it or not. She probably lobbied for the position. She loves being in the position, and he is the most anti-black president since Woodrow Wilson. Somebody present empirical evidence to show me where I'm wrong.
Well, okay, I'm not going to say you're wrong.
You can't say I'm wrong.
Well, let me talk a little bit about, because I was the convention chairman when we invited Rance Priebus to come to NABJ in Massachusetts. Let me tell you, it was a very delicate negotiation. I mean, he got down to what color chairs is he going to be sitting in. There was a question of whether or not he could make a speech, and I emphatically said no. I said, you can give a 2 or 3 minute statement, but you got to take questions. One of the things that we have kind of stopped, because we had some problems before with an administration official, Valerie Jarrett, who came and gave a speech. And I am a founder of the NABJ Political Reporters Task Force. And one of the things we said, we can no longer have people come in and give speeches. And so, with that said, I was not involved in negotiations to bring Omarosa Newman to NABJ. But as a rule, we bring people different persuasions, of political persuasions and political bents, to NABJ. That is not uncommon. I just think I think Carla was correct. Things went off the rails a little bit. I think I've known Ed Gordon, because he and I worked together at BET.
Uh-huh.
He is a capable individual, but I think sometimes the moment gets to us. And, you know, I don't know if I would have done what he did. But I can tell you, he did preface some of his questioning by saying that there is an elephant in the room, and that I think that many of our members wanted her to address some issues as it was related to the Trump administration. But let me also say that that was just the culmination of everything, because she came in on, I think she came in, what was that, Thursday night? She was jeered. I saw her earlier that morning on Friday getting coffee and a pair of, you know, I guess they call yoga pants and a hat. So she was kind of trying to be incognito. And, look, you can't. I think sometimes people look at our convention as it's a platform. That's exactly what it is. Young people, especially our young journalists, some of them are very emotional. You know, I sit through some pretty strange press conferences sometimes, and you know, and this is a learning experience. We had young people stand up during the middle of that presentation and turn their backs on them. I personally just didn't feel as though she was the wrong person to put in the mix with two people who lost relatives and children.
Understood.
I was like, I was having difficulty with that. But I also remind you that she was a last-minute ad.
Understood. Charles, I want to play some sound from the president, from the 45th president,
sure,
making these comments, where he once again blamed both sides for the Charlottesville attacks.
Define alt-right to me. You define it. Go ahead.
Well, I'm saying, as
no,
Senator,
define it for me. Come on, let's go. Define
Senator
it for
McCain
me.
Defined them as the same group.
Okay, what about the alt-left that came charging at Excuse me. What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt? Let me ask you this. What about the fact they came charging, that they came charging with clubs in their hand, swinging clubs? Do they have any problem? I think they do. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that was a horrible, horrible day. Wait a minute. I'm not finished. I'm not finished, fake news. That was a horrible day. I will tell you something. I watched those very closely, much more closely than you people watched it. And you have you had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
So the white supremacists of this nation, whether it be the Ku Klux Klan or the alt-right or neo-Nazis, they had their white knight in the White House. They had their Grand Kleagel in the White House, the 45th president of the United States. You heard him defending. You heard him defend. You heard him, the 45th president of the United States, defend the men who were gathered for this gathering, whatever they call it, Unite the Right thing. He defended him clearly and plainly.
You know, and they take a lot of energy from his words. Even after the first statement that he made, the very tepid, you know, equivocal statement he made, the website, the alt-right white nationalist website Stormfront had, you know, kind of dissected his remarks. There were people on Reddit and 4chan, you know, those alt-right groups, who said, you know, look at what he said. He's supporting us. He said both sides. He's not blaming.
He's not condemning us.
You know, he's not condemning us. They specifically are looking for his support. And now he doubled down on that. So basically what he did was just almost give him carte blanche to continue or perhaps escalate what their plans are and what they're doing. This is really big for them right now. What just went down this afternoon is big for them.
Indeed. Pia Jordan, I want to bring you into the conversation. I know you're here to talk about the fact that you're MSU ABJ advisor. But I would ask you, what do you think about what we were just talking about? Because I know you have an opinion about it.
Well, as a journalist, I try not to share my opinions. Well. But this was the first time I heard what the president had said this afternoon. And it's interesting, last night there was a PBS broadcast that was publicized about Jasper, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interesting. It was talking about a black man who had, in the 1990s, who had been chained.
Robert Byrd, the tragic death of Robert Byrd.
Yes, and I watched it last night. And in light of what I just heard that the president says, it just means even more that we as journalists have to look beyond his offensive language about fake news and continue to do our jobs and prepare the next set of students to be the journalists to put the president, to ask the tough questions of the president. This is a very dangerous time, and I see that. And his language is such that our country, in a sense, is a powder keg.
It is, and Sister Jordan, I agree. I'm a journalist too. I've been one for more than 25 years. But before I'm a journalist, and I don't mean to be cute, but I'm a black man. I'm a black man from West Baltimore, and you're right. We are sitting on a powder keg, and you know Malcolm X talked about a powder keg being in the House of America back in the 1960s. Well, in 2017, we find ourselves again confronted with a powder keg of race, and this is where we are. This is our reality. So I get objectivity, and I attempt to be most times. But on this subject, I'm not going to even pretend.
Well, one of the things, too, I tell my students, I don't tell them to be objective. I just tell them to be neutral. Because I know they're coming into, for instance, when the Trayvon Martin, there was a demonstration in Baltimore. I said, okay, we're going down there to cover it. But remember, you're neutral. You know, you're not part of
truth.
The environment. You are neutral. 'Cause we all come from different backgrounds, and we bring different things to the table. So I don't expect them to be objective. I know there's going to be some subjectivity. But I'm really irritated every time the president says fake news, because it's demeaning what we do. And it's as if we are not legitimate. So the issues that are being brought up, the questions about how can you say this and why did it take you 2 days in to say actually what these groups were doing, the white supremacists, the Nazi group. So my concern is on the issue of that we not let up, that we as journalists are telling the stories so that we can just open the eyes of people, not just our African-American people, but other people to what is actually going on in our country.
And, you know, I sat on a panel at NABJ about the black press. Actually, Sean should have been there. but one of the things we talked about on that panel and that I stressed, because, of course, the black press, made its mark as an advocacy journalist arm. And, you know, advocacy journalism now has kind of taken a hit. And even amongst black journalists, people, you know, look down on, you know, so-called advocacy journalism. Mm. But I say, you know, as we just said, there's no such thing as objectivity. We can just strive to be fair and balanced. And I say as journalists, everyone is advocating, really, for something. We know what the far right is advocating for, Fox News and those folks are. But a lot of mainstream outlets, what they're advocating is just the status quo. When a story happens and they only talk to elected officials or, you know, the usual suspects, police chiefs and, you know, that kind of thing, and don't actually talk to the community, don't talk to the most affected people, the disaffected, the folks who are organizing, the activists, those folks, when they don't include all voices, then they're advocating for the status quo. So if you're a journalist and you work for an outlet that really does reach out to it, be more inclusive, expand the conversation to include all these other voices, right, then you're called advocates. Right. Not, but I say you're being, you know, that's when you're really in telling the whole story, being more broad and inclusive. And that's what where the stories are. And that's what real journalism should be about.
Well, I'm an advocacy journalist and proud of it. Charles, I'll give you the last word. You only got about 45 seconds, though, brother. Go ahead.
I think this is calculating. I think that the president, you know, was loath to really to address this on the day that the incident happened on Saturday. And it was only after the reaction that he came back around and said, okay, I'm going to denounce these folks. But I think his calculation is this. If I pit each of them against each other, I look like the hero.
Hmm. Wow.
Well, if you're a black journalist right now and you're not advocating for black lives...
Oh, I'm not. I'm not saying it's me. I'm saying the president is calculating.
No, I know.
Right. We gotta wind the segment down, unfortunately. Charles Robinson's reporter for Maryland Public Television State Circle. Charles, good to hear from you, man. Appreciate you.
Good to hear from you, too.
Carla Wills is senior producer of Democracy Now!, former executive producer of First Edition. Carla, always good to hear from you as well, sis.
Good to be with you, and congrats to Morgan State University.
Yes, I was waiting for that.
Black journalist. Had to get that in. Congratulations, chapter of the year, student chapter of the year.
That's right. Morgan State University, Association of Black Journalists, they were named Student Chapter of the Year.
That's an awesome accomplishment. That's an awesome accomplishment. Pia Jordan is Assistant Professor of Multimedia Journalism here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication, also MSUABJ, the number one chapter in the nation, advisor. Pia Jordan, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Look, hold on, Bobby, Leo, Valerie. We will get to your calls, but we're going to bring on Ron Cassie, senior editor of Baltimore Magazine, talking about his latest story on the great Thurgood Marshall. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Making the transition from reporting on the NABJ convention to the life legacy of Thurgood Marshall, the Baltimore native Thurgood Marshall, 50 years after he was installed as the nation's first black U.S. Supreme Court justice. In the studio with me is Ron Cassie, senior editor of Baltimore Magazine, who wrote this story, an excellent story, Ron, about Thurgood Justice, about Justice Marshall. Welcome back, Ron.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Before we get into the conversation, let me take a few phone calls so people do want to get things off of their chest about what as far as the first segment and that and the again defacing, not just not defacing, but knocking down of that protest statue in Wyman Dell just moments ago. I almost witnessed it firsthand. Let's go to Bobby, who wants to talk about it quickly. Bobby, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
How you doing? I just wanted to touch on the fact that the Trump man said he didn't have nothing to say. And then yesterday, well, he was mandated to say something. Today, he showed his real true colors.
I agree.
How can you sit there and say, they want to tear down Robert E. Lee? What's next? George Washington? Jefferson? Come on now. That's giving fuel to all those off-right white supremacy people to even gather more numbers of themselves now. I mean, I'm really appalled, this president. I mean, I thought I went through a whole lot with Reagan, but this man is just out of, I mean, anyway,
Bobby,
as a black man like myself, I mean, like yourself, grew up in Southwest Baltimore, and today at 50, 65 years old, I find myself fighting in two fronts, one against the white supremacy and corrupt police, and the other is the black youth on the street killing themselves, and look, guess what? Two fronts in the same country.
All right, Bobby, thank you for your comment. We appreciate it. Let's move on, though. Let's go to Brother Leo Burroughs in Bolton Hill. Brother Burroughs, you're on First Edition. How are you doing?
Good evening, Brother Sean Yost.
Good evening,
everybody. Brother. Well, Donald Trump will say and do anything to become a king. He's aspiring to dictatorship for real, and that means abrogating, getting rid of the Congress of the United States and doing what he wants to do unilaterally, and he's willing to support the white militias in this country who are armed, locked, and loaded. So we had better understand that there are a variety of strategies, but we have to understand that if it becomes to a physical confrontation, we have to be prepared for that as well, not assuming that all will be nonviolent. I'd like to think about nonviolence, but the reality is that we can be put today or tomorrow in concentration camps in this country, given the weak leadership of too many black leaders who somehow don't believe what's happening is really happening. Yeah. We better wake up.
All right, Brother Burroughs, thank you. Let's go to Valerie in Baltimore. Valerie, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, Sean. I'm outraged by them defacing just trying to destroy the statue. But I'm going to tell you, the thing about, and people say, well, it's not all white people, but in my opinion, from what I'm seeing right now, it's a great majority of white people who seem to think that they have a right to attack us when we are the ones who should be angry. We're the ones who were enslaved. We were the ones who are oppressed. But then they have the nerve to be angry because they're being called out on their racism. This is despicable. And this country is going to pay for what is happening right now. But believe this, that president is going to, when Mueller is done, he will pay for all of the things he's doing. And I believe in my heart that the reason why he's acting out now is because he's going all the way down. And yeah. I cannot wait for that day to come.
All right, Valerie, thank you. Let's take one more quick call. Let's go to Youssef, who wants to talk about the protest statue. Youssef, you're on First Edition.
Good afternoon.
Good evening. Good evening.
Sean, I wanted to commend you on your opening statement because you're dead on and right on point. This is a war, and anybody that does not realize that and act accordingly will be in a lot of trouble. I am personally going to be training my son and my daughter in self-defense, and they will be armed and ready, as well as intellectually, as well as physically. But they will be armed and ready because we are literally, you are correct, at war. And we better get with the program, period.
All right. Youssef, thank you for your comment. We appreciate it. Now back to Ron Cassie, who I, again, as I alluded to, wrote an outstanding article, outstanding story about the legendary Thurgood Marshall, the Baltimore native, the 50 years after he was installed as the U.S. Supreme Court's first black justice. Again, Ron, congratulations on this. You opened with the harrowing account of Thurgood Marshall almost being taken to the banks of the Duck River. Tell the listeners what this was all about.
So 1946, Thurgood Marshall's the chief counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and there's a race riot, the first post-World War II race riot in Columbia, Tennessee. There's a fight that breaks out. A black serviceman stands up for his mother, essentially. He's thrown into jail, of course. He gets a couple punches in, and he's going to be taken out of jail and lynched. A mob is formed. He gets whisked out of Columbia, and eventually 25 African-Americans end up going on trial after a confrontation with police that lasts a couple days. Thurgood Marshall wins acquittal with the great NAACP team of 23 of those 25 accused.
So 23 of the 25 that were accused down there in Tennessee, in the midst of this or in the aftermath of this race riot that happened down there, post-World War II race, 23 of 25 were actually acquitted.
Yeah, and there's an armed confrontation. You know, African-Americans rural South are have shotguns. They
Absolutely.
Hunt, to feed the family and everything else. Buckshot, you know, some officers were killed. Two African-Americans who were arrested died in police custody, were killed, shot in police custody. So it takes months to go through the trials. Eventually, they're moved to a neighboring county. And he wins the acquittal, but obviously people in Columbia, Tennessee, a lot of them weren't happy with the acquittals. And you know, it was a sundown town. They go after Marshall after the acquittal, following his car.
Well, let's explain. Some listeners don't know what a sundown town is. I remember you brought up sundown, but I remember Nina Totenberg, the great legal correspondent reporter. In Washington, saying that there was a sheriff who told Marshall, if you're not out of this town before the sun goes down, you won't make it out of this town.
So there's signs posted in Columbia, Tennessee, and I don't want to use the word, but, you know, and read and run. Don't let the sun go down on you here. If you can't read, run anyway.
Yeah.
And he faced that for decades in the South, as did every African-American. So he crosses the Duck River on a bridge, driving with a couple attorneys and actually a journalist, and he gets pulled over. He's accused of driving drunk. They haven't had anything to drink. It's a dry county, albeit they were looking apparently for liquor.
Well, Marshall, I mean, Thurgood Marshall enjoyed a beverage now and again. There's no doubt about that. I know that for a fact. Professor Larry Gibson, University of Maryland Law School, affirmed that. So I know that's true. But
absolutely. I interviewed a bunch of his former law clerks for the story, and everybody affirms that. But Marshall says, we were looking for some liquor, but we couldn't find any. He's stones cold sober. They eventually separate him from the other people in his car, shove him in the back of a vehicle. These are armed deputies, law enforcement, shove him in the back of an unmarked car. He recounted this later. I mean, it's Marshall did himself in interviews. They told the other people they're going to drive him back to see a judge in Columbia. Alexander Luby, another famous, becomes famous civil rights lawyer, sees the car veer off the road that has Marshall in it, and it goes going down a dirt path, and he gives chase, turns around. And Marshall said it wasn't until they were down close to the water, to the banks, that he really feared for his life, that there was white people, you know, with the intent of lynching him. And it's only because Luby, with another white attorney, with another white journalist in tow, we assume the people who abducted Marshall decided they weren't going to kill four people that day, and he survives. It's emblematic. I mean, I think the reason we said to start with that story is for 20 years after Marshall gets out of law school, leading up to Brown versus Board of Education, he's traveling 50,000 miles a year in the South, crisscrossing the country by train, often alone, often in these sundown towns, life threatened repeatedly. I mean, his life was threatened by the KKK in 1934 when he was representing Donald Murray to desegregate the University of Maryland Law School.
I think it can't be stated more strongly. This is one of the most courageous men, really, of the 20th century. When you think about what he confronted on a very regular basis, the threat of death and bodily injury, because he was doing this incredibly perilous work.
Yeah, you know, as I started looking into the story, and I'm, you know, one of the things I started to do is I went through some lists of like 100 most influential Americans, the Smithsonian Magazine, mm-hmm. Time, mm-hmm. The Atlantic, and Thurgood Marshall doesn't appear on some mm-hmm. lists.
Yeah,
and almost nobody had a bigger impact in the 20th century than Thurgood Marshall. Franklin Roosevelt, Martin Luther King comes, you know, notably after Thurgood Marshall, when frustration that Brown is not being implemented fast enough, and the physical courage, as you say, displayed over decades, time and time again, is incredible.
Let's talk about Marshall's legacy now that we are. What is the date of the 50 years? When will we mark 50 years since he's been installed as U.S. Supreme Court Justice?
So on August 30th.
Okay.
The Coming Senate up. Confirms Thurgood Marshall, 1967. He's sworn in September 1st. We kind of took the August 30th date because it goes our best of
that's
all
right.
tomorrow.
That's right.
Issue.
That makes sense. So, yeah. Makes sense. Editorially, understood. But Marshall, along with his mentor, Charles Hamlin Houston, two of the great legal minds of the 20th century. Easily. Right?
I don't think there's any doubt Thurgood Marshall is the greatest attorney and most influential attorney of the 20th century. And that's limiting him to just his legal impact, right?
Right.
I don't think there's any question about that. And yet it's remarkable. I talked to a lot. And I can't say I knew all this about him before I did the research either. Larry Gibson, reading his book when it came out, was really eye-opening for me a couple years ago. But you can ask attorneys. And they won't mention Thurgood. If you say, who's the most influential attorney of the 20th? Or his name doesn't come to everybody's lips the way it should. I mean, really, on the most influential list, you know, Rosa Parks will often be number 5 or 10, and Thurgood Marshall might be 86. And not to take anything away, but
when
The Atlantic is interviewing 10 historians and they've got those reversed, there's something that the country has missed in terms of his legacy.
I think that I know that you're right 100%. I think the full story of Thurgood Marshall has not been told to a great extent. And you're also right, Professor Larry Gibson's Young Thurgood, The Making of a Supreme Court Justice, the definitive biography of Marshall as far as his younger years is concerned, at least in my mind. And one of the things that Professor Gibson said to me all the time is that Marshall never got the respect that he was due. And he points to a couple of things. And one of the things that he points to is the book by Bob Woodward about the Supreme Court, where he sort of characterized Thurgood as being not so serious, as being kind of the jester, the joker on the court, and not reverencing him the way he should be reverenced as the great legal mind that he was and the great legal warrior that he was, because Bob Woodward or nobody else was going to go through what he went through during those decades.
Well, I spent a day with Professor Gibson beyond a number of telephone calls and emails and everything at the University of Maryland Law Library with a couple of his law students. He's researching his next book, which covers a lot of the period that I wrote about, the 20 years from graduation to the Brown versus Board of Education. And I think it's easy to if you look at his career as a Supreme Court justice when he's in a dissent, I think a lot of people maybe have mischaracterized his personality, versus his incomparable intellect that he brought. Very few people are famous before they become a Supreme Court justice. Very few.
True.
And Thurgood Marshall would have been a colossus figure in American history if he had never been named the Supreme Court
Absolutely.
Justice. And I haven't read Bob Woodward's book, but
yeah, Professor Gibson is not a big fan of Woodward's back book. I see in the article you have this first story, really, the Afro covered Thurgood Marshall's career from the time he really was in high school, because he was a champion debater in high school. Douglas High School was maybe the greatest debating high school in the country, one of them. They went and debated colleges, actually. And Marshall, when he got to college, Lincoln University, debated Oxford, was the captain of the debate team, I believe. an unbelievable career as a debater, a champion debater, and it obviously served him well as a lawyer. But the Afro covered his career literally from the time he was graduating from high school all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, thank God for the Afro, and thank God those archives are digitized online now.
Absolutely.
They're unbelievable resource. The major, I guess, or white dailies in the cities just we're not covering, Black Baltimore.
Well, not then and not now, as you say, thank God for the Afro. I will say that, obviously. But you went deep, man, for this story, because I see a lot of the stuff that you're talking about. I know about because of Professor Gibson, but a lot of people don't know about, don't have this information. His grandfather starting the grocery store, Thornygood Marshall, on Dolphin Street. His public school education, which a lot of people miss that foundation of his, because he was taught because of segregation by brilliant teachers. I mean, most of the teachers that taught in those schools had PhDs.
Yeah, there's a couple things that were interesting. Both of his grandfathers are really remarkable. One grandfather was an escaped slave from Virginia who eventually, after the Civil War, becomes a Buffalo Soldier and heads the Texas. I mean, I don't know what would possess somebody to do that after escaping slavery in Virginia to join the U.S. Cavalry and head to Texas. But that was his one grandfather. The other grandfather served in the Civil War on a Navy ship. He has a remarkable family, and as you say, he grows up in this crucible of West Baltimore, which is a mecca of education, achievement, activism, culture, and he's also having these experiences as a B&O porter, as a waiter at Gibson Island, where he's coming into contact with white people and people of power and of means and of political clout, and I think Thurgood Marshall was probably somebody always very comfortable in his skin. But I think the sociability of rubbing shoulders in those as a B&O porter, as a waiter, really paid dividends when he went into the Deep South. He knew he did not alienate people. He was, an optimistic person by nature. And I think that's important. There's a couple other takeaways that surprised me beyond his family history, which is really interesting. There's a couple other takeaways, like the evolution to Brown, that it starts with they're looking for, equal facility that's separate but equal.
Right.
They want equal pay, and they realize that's never really going to come, but equal facilities, equal pay, maybe they can break the bank of the state and local governments, and then they'll desegregate out of need. Maryland wasn't going to build two law schools.
Right.
And then that's still not working. And then they go directly at desegregation. So that evolution over 20 years of the strategy, Thurgood Marshall puts this in the context of struggle of human rights. In the very, very rarely in the United States do we use the language of human rights to look at our own record. We look at Russia or North Korea and use human rights.
Right.
Thurgood Marshall, man born 1908, is using the language of human rights, which is really interesting. And just the last thing I'll mention is, the Senate confirmation vote actually is really interesting to look at. He's confirmed 69-11, and it's written quite a bit that Lyndon Johnson had twisted the arms of Southern senators, Dixiecrats, not to vote, to abstain essentially. But when you look at the vote, it's actually a lot of Midwestern, Western, and Northern senators who abstain. George McGovern.
McGovern?
Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin, who founded Earth Day. Mike Mansfield of Montana. Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota were no votes. Didn't vote. They abstained. And I think it's easy to question their integrity or their character by not voting on Thurgood Marshall's confirmation. But it really speaks, I think, to the country at that time in 1967, that they were worried about their reelection if they voted for Thurgood Marshall in states like South Dakota, Montana, Wisconsin, Minnesota.
Fascinating.
It's fascinating, yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. You going back to something that you alluded to a moment ago, Ron, one of the things that I learned in the research and the work that I've done as far as Marshall is concerned is that he had the ability to make friends across the aisle, allies where there would be no allies in under normal circumstances. There's a case down in Prince George's County where he had to deal with a prosecutor who was a notoriously racist gentleman. And because Marshall was able to somehow, charm him, he was able to get some traction in that case and ultimately win the case. This is a narrative that repeats itself over and over again, and I think it goes back to what you spoke about his growing up, being a waiter at on Gibson Island and interfacing and interacting with people of power and white people as a young man, and not being intimidated in the process as he went forward and when it came later.
Right, not intimidated. He lawyers have a certain camaraderie, and he didn't alienate people. He spoke very plainly when Felix Frankfurter, the Supreme Court Justice, asked him what equality was, and he said the same thing, same place at the same time. Very, plain-spoken individual. Enjoy the company of lawyers, opposing lawyers, and even these really racist judges in the South. You know, they had been to law school. They didn't want to look foolish, clearly making a ruling that would be overturned on appeal. I mean, they could see the writing on the wall, so to speak. And he played by the rules when he was in the South too. You know, if it was sundown, he wasn't supposed to be out. He wasn't.
I wouldn't either.
Right, and that was part of his strategy to go along and to win the battles in court, was not to alienate people. He didn't have to do that for his ego too. You know, he could share credit with other people. I think is why people liked him so much. It wasn't about his ego. He was able to share credit with others.
The bottom line is that this is a towering legacy. 50 years since he was installed as the first black U.S. Supreme Court justice, and a man who, the greatest legal mind of the 20th century, but unfortunately still to this day responsible, think that the was, and his ascension has not been told, and until it is.
When I was a young man, was, you know, a heavyset figure in the black robes, and I didn't know this history.
Right.
The 20 major motion picture coming out starring Chad Boseman, original movie. I think athlete, there's when folks die, you don't get when you're go online and it's on season. His great sense of humor is apparent. Or an interview with Mike Wallace from 1957
at Baltimore Magazine. His story this month is about the towering legacy of Thurgood Marshall, Baltimore native, first black Supreme Court justice of the United States. And it's good to see you.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the second hour of First Edition will lead off with Navasha Dea and Fanon Hill. They are the founders of the Youth Resiliency Institute, and they've got the Cherry Hill Festival coming up. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. ¶¶